If you came to work dressed like that, poor Sid Matthews would swallow his cigar. Once around the park, Clifford, we don't want to be too early. Greetings and salutations, wonderful people. How you doing? This is Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster here on the Mystery Hour. Thank you for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Treat to have you with me. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Terrence Faraday bring us our first story. It's called Margot and the Femme Fatale. The next time the station is passing out free Dodger tickets, Ms. Banning, keep me in mind. Margot, the Banning addressed, stopped in mid-stride. I beg your pardon? She liked the man who'd stopped her, Sid Matthews, one of the panelists on the radio show she oversaw, Gotham Goings On. Matthews was a moonlighting sports columnist for the New York Herald Tribune, who reminded Margot of her grandfather, being short and gray and liberally sprinkled with cigar ash. And he was the least troublesome of the show's three regulars. The least temperamental as well. Even this remark about free tickets, which would have sounded like a complaint coming from Mamie Gallagher, Gotham's statuesque show business expert, had made it, was merely a pleasant greeting from a smiling Matthews. What had stopped Margot in her tracks, only 10 minutes from airtime, the busiest 10 minutes of her Sunday afternoon, was the remark's complete lack of sense. Matthews proceeded to thicken the fog. "Your station's a political commentator. What's his name, Cleghorn?"
"Yes, Cyrus P. Cleghorn," Margot said.
"Well, he was hurrying out as I came in today. Told me he'd been given tickets to Brooklyn's doubleheader against the Cardinals this afternoon. Oh, I wouldn't mind having a couple of those myself."
"Your paper doesn't give you tickets?"
"My paper gets me into the press box, but these tickets were for the owner's box, the best seat in Ebbets Field. You can smell the chewing tobacco from those."
Margot could only shrug.
"Well, that's first I've heard about tickets," she said. Matthews looked as puzzled as Margot felt.
"Well, you know, that's strange. Cleghorn said that the ducats came from you. That's what Philip St. Pierre told him when he passed them over. He said you knew Cleghorn was a big Dodgers fan."
The only thing Margot knew about Cleghorn were that he suffered from dandruff and he'd picked Wendell Willkie in the last presidential election, a Roosevelt landslide. But something else Matthews had said was a ray of light. The man at the center of the mystery was Philip St. Pierre, the third member of the Gotham Goings On panel. St. Pierre was Gotham's expert on local crime, though his commentaries had taken on a more international flavor some months back when he'd suddenly declared war on Nazi saboteurs and spies in the New York area. Since then, the radio criminologist had been racking up successes and steadily adding members to his spy-busting squad, as Margot, the first draftee, knew only too well. She also knew that St. Pierre was always either working an angle or working out the next one. Margot would have gone directly to the source to ask about his latest scheme if it hadn't been so close to broadcast time. She told Matthews to report for duty and then hurried to the control booth of Studio A. When she arrived, she saw that St. Pierre was already seated inside the little paneled studio beyond the control booth's soundproof glass, chatting away with Mamie Gallagher. Conspiring, Margot thought, as she always did when she saw two blondes in conversation. Her own hair was currently auburn. She picked up the clipboard, which held her program notes. Gallagher, St. Pierre, and Matthews all submitted a list of topics each week, though only Matthews' list could be relied on. Gallagher, for example, never mentioned the unauthorized commercials she inserted for her furriers and dress salons she supported and who, if Margot's suspicions were correct,
supported her in return. On her current sheet, Gallagher had listed the latest dirt on a Broadway director's divorce and a belated review of the play Minuet, which had been broadcast on New York's experimental television station in July. Television, Margot thought and sniffed loudly. Very loudly, apparently, because her boss, Raymond Pedigo, turned in his seat at the control board and said, "Aha! I heard you had a cold, Margot." She was about to deny the report when something on her clipboard caught her eye. She'd flipped ahead to St. Pierre's list of topics. It consisted of a single item printed boldly. "Affect a cold and go home sick." Yeah, she said to Pedigo. I came down with it rather suddenly. Yeah, summer colds are the worst. You know my policy, Margot. If you're sick, you're home. But can keep the program logged today. In the studio, St. Pierre was smiling at her as though he'd heard the whole exchange. Right, Margot said after quietly removing St. Pierre's note. She handed the clipboard to the sound man at the control column. Bud Budwing, and left the booth. So dazed by this turn of events that she thought she might actually be coming down with something. Possibly brain fever? Once out on the radio station's reception area, she told the young woman behind the desk that she was going homesick. The receptionist, whose name was Jinx, replied, "Yeah, I heard Mr. St. Pierre left you a get-well card." "What, no flowers?" Margot waited to open the plain white envelope until she was inside one of Radio Center's free-falling elevators. The envelope contained a sheet of writing paper folded into a square. Unfolding it, it revealed the blue emblem of the Yale Club, St. Pierre's current residence, and a handwritten message. "Clifford is waiting with the car. You'll need a dress suitable for afternoon tea on Fifth Avenue. Think timeless elegance." Margot stepped out into the heat of the day, marveling at the number of times counter-espionage work required a change of wardrobe. She'd so far been asked to dress up as a maid and as a deckhand on a crab boat, though in each case the costumes had been provided. Today's change would be a challenge, she knew, though like any up-and-coming professional woman in 1941, she owned an afternoon dress or two. Hers were more dated than timeless and more shop-worn than elegant. As promised, St. Pierre's driver, Cliff Cleary, was waiting by the curb next to the Spy Smasher's gleaming Packard Super 8. The former linebacker blushed at the sight of her. He always did, but today it settled Margot's nerves. Whatever the state of Cleary's own nerves, he managed to drive her to her little apartment house in Greenwich Village without a mishap. It being Sunday, her roommate, a model for several top fashion designers, and her neighbor, a shoe buyer for Macy's, were both at home, recovering from their Saturday nights. Margot was able to borrow a striking blue dress, matching shoes, and a handbag only slightly too sequined for an afternoon affair, even on Fifth Avenue. She switched on the apartment's radio while she dressed. The set, which happened to be tuned to Gotham's Going On, came to life while Philip St. Pierre was speaking. "Me to explain. The Soviet delegates are in the United States to negotiate an arms purchase, perhaps the first step toward a Russian lend-lease. Little did they know that by stopping over in New York, they were risking the success of their mission. In Washington, should they make it, they'll only be surrounded by politicians and lobbyists. Here in New York, they're in deadly danger for Nazi spies and assassins. Not to mention the outrageous prices, Philip, darling," Mamie Gallagher cut in. "Oh, thank goodness for reasonable little shops like Marcel's." Margot switched off the set with emphasis just as Cliff Cleary sounded his horn. A few minutes later, they were speeding back uptown in light traffic. Though they made good time, Philip St. Pierre, freed from his broadcast duties, was already on the corner of Fifth Avenue and 50th Street, awaiting them. Or perhaps waiting for next year's Easter parade to start, Margot thought, In his pearl-colored suit and matching Homburg, St. Pierre currently looked ready to have his picture taken for the rotogravure. Habitually overdressing had worked out for him. For once, she concluded, as St. Pierre was always properly dressed for tea. He raised his stick to signal them.
"Good work, Clifford," he said as he slipped into the back seat. "Extremely good work, Margot."
Margot adjusted her hemline. "If you'd tell me ahead of time about these costume parties, I could come to work prepared."
"If you came to work dressed like that, poor Sid Matthews would swallow his cigar."
"Once around the park, Clifford, we don't want to be too early."
"Speaking of Sidney," Margot said, "he told me something curious just before I was laid low by my midsummer cold. Something about Dodger tickets?"
"And you'd like an explanation? Oh, I'm disappointed, Margot. You know my methods. Apply them." Margot had already devoted some thought to the subject while being driven about.
"Well, you found out somehow that Cyrus Cleghorn roots for the Dodgers, so you handed him seats to the owner's box to get him out to Brooklyn. If I had to guess how you got the tickets, I'd say it was your gangster buddy Dante the Inferno Giancarlo. I remember he was wearing a Brooklyn cap when you introduced us. Did he strong-arm the owner?"
"Oh, surely not. Dante is the soul of tact. But why would I care how Cyrus Cleghorn spent his Sunday afternoon?"
"Because he was invited to this mysterious Fifth Avenue affair, and you weren't. I'm guessing you volunteered to take Cleghorn's place so he could enjoy his peanuts and Cracker Jack with a clear conscience."
"Very good, Margot." St. Pierre pulled a cream-colored card from his breast pocket. "Our second-hand invitation." Margot examined the card. "A reception in honor of a Soviet delegation? The one you were talking about on the air just now?"
"The very same.
Back in 1939, when the Soviets invaded Finland, my cousin Franklin froze all Soviet assets in U.S. banks. Now that the Soviet Union is being invaded by Germany, those funds have been released. This delegation is here to use the money to buy war materiel. Fighter planes, specifically. Our opponents would like to stop them."
This was the first time St. Pierre had brought up his supposed kinship with the president since the day he and Margot began catching spies together. Margot ignored the urge to pursue the opening and stuck instead to the matter at hand.
"What makes you think our opponents will be visiting?"
She consulted the card again. "Mrs. Constantine Volganzy, also known as the Countess Vera Volganzy. I think our enemies will be there because I believe the Countess to be an enemy herself. You mentioned Dante Giancarlo and his ball cap just now. Well, I'm sure you remember the case that brought you three together."
"Of course, Philip. It's only been a month. You were after Wilhelm Friedel, a Nazi courier who jumped bail. You knew he was leaving the country on a yacht called the Spindrift. Your friend Dante, the patriotic gangster, lent us his gunman himself and a launch fast enough to catch the Spindrift, which we did."
"Speaking of Dante," St. Pierre said with a casualness bordering on indifference, "has he called to ask you out? He told me he intended to." Margot heard the front seat groan as Cliff Cleary leaned backward to hear her answer. St. Pierre had tilted his long nose her way as well.
"Let's focus, boys," she said. "What does this Countess Volganzy have to do with Friedel?"
"Well, the Spindrift belonged to her, until it was stolen some weeks back, or so she now claims. The yacht was a present from her financier father on the occasion of her marriage to Count Volganzy, an impoverished and feeble-minded Balkan playboy who lives to play polo. The Countess's pursuits are far more practical.
I believe she's something of a financier herself. In fact, I suspect her of secretly backing a good portion of the fascist espionage effort in the East Coast. I'm fairly certain that she provided Wilhelm Friedel's bail money. Okay, why would a fascist sympathizer be entertaining Russia's diplomats?
Why, indeed. It can't be to wish them well. I think you and I should be there to warn the Russians to be on guard, and to guard them if it should come to that. Besides, I've always wanted to meet a femme fatale in the flesh.
I'm told the Countess resembles Joan Bennett, the movie star now that Miss Bennett has gone from blonde tresses to brunette.
Margot, who preferred Jean Arthur, said, "Are you sure you can handle the temptation?"
"Oh, that's why I have you, Margot. If she should start to sing, you can tie me to the mast.
I think we've stalled long enough, Clifford. Take us to Fifth Avenue and head uptown."
St. Pierre began to fidget, which made Margot nervous in turn. She diverted herself with the parade of Gilded Age mansions sweeping past her window. "What's going to happen to all these old piles?" she wondered aloud.
"A few are already schools," St. Pierre said. "Others museums. I think there's even a consulate or two. One, our destination, might be called a secret consulate. There it is on the right, Clifford, that Italianate structure in white marble built by the Countess' grandfather and no doubt modeled after a famous Venetian palazzo, or maybe two. There's a parking space opening up for us in the same block. It's almost as though they were expecting us."
"Bite your tongue," Margot said. The mansion's front doors were guarded by a pair of footmen, the first Margot had ever seen in the flesh. They briefly examined the cream card St. Pierre handed them, and they threw open the heavy doors. Margot inhaled involuntarily at the revealed splendor. An odd place for a communist to come.
Any port in their current storm, I think.
Margot would never hear that particular thought. A tall, thin man with dark, ridiculously curly hair and wild, protruding eyes came up to them in a rush.
"Gilbert, old man, thank heaven for a friendly face. What a day we are wasting."
I beg your pardon, St. Pierre said.
"We should be enjoying a chucker or two and such a glorious afternoon. What?"
The man's thick and hard-to-place accent, his reference to polo, and the fact that he was scandalously underdressed in a houndstooth sport coat and baggy flannels, allowed Margot to conclude that this was their host, Count Konstantin Volgezny, the feeble-minded nobleman who had provided his bride with a title. St. Pierre had apparently arrived at the same conclusion.
"Well, I'm afraid, Count—" "Oh, no, no, call me Gani, please. I love it when Americans call me Gani. Come, let's have a drink. We're in the foyer today. So much less formal than the Great Hall and cooler, what?"
The foyer was actually a reception room of gray stone with a fireplace on one end, whose hearth was as large, Margot judged, as her bedroom. One of the foyer's walls was made up entirely of tall windows that overlooked a courtyard. A string quartet played softly by the light from those windows, for their own amusement apparently, for no one in the crowd of 100 or so people appeared to be listening. Volgezny waved to a passing footman who was balancing a tray of champagne glasses. The Count handed one glass to Margot and another to St. Pierre before taking a third for himself. He raised his glass, opened his mouth as though to give a toast, and then shut it quickly. Margot turned to follow his gaze and found herself face to face with a striking woman whose violet frock seemed to glow in the gray room.
"Vera, my dear," Volgezny said, "these are polo friends of mine. They do not want to talk any of your boring politics."
Oh, so this was the femme fatale.
Margot agreed that she did resemble Joan Bennett, with her high arched eyebrows, a straight nose that broadened at the tip, and lips that would take some time to rouge. And to unrouge. A challenge the grinning St. Pierre seemed to Margot to be contemplating. The Countess was perhaps a year or two older than the actress, and her lustrous dark hair longer, reaching almost to her shoulders. "It's impossible to imagine your wife saying anything boring," St. Pierre crooned. Then he drank to her while Margot wondered if she might actually have to tie him to something. Volganzi's laugh was a startling high-pitched titter.
"A very gallant Gilbert, come and see my latest trophy."
The Count linked arms with St. Pierre and addressed his wife over his shoulder.
"You entertain this charming young lady for a moment, my dear."
Margot watched the men go with alarm. Just 2 hours back, she'd been planning to spend a quiet evening with the Sunday funnies. Now she was alone with the real-life dragon lady. Without thinking, she raised her glass to her lips.
"I wouldn't do that," the Countess said in a whisper.
I beg your pardon?"
Countess Volganzi smiled sweetly. "If you drink from that glass, you'll never leave this house alive."
She took Margot's elbow and led her toward a small mirror-topped table that supported a tower of stargazer lilies. Margot noted that her hostess's fingertips were trembling.
"Smile," the Countess said, "or we're lost. Your drink has been drugged. When we reach the table, drop your bag. Before you retrieve it, put your glass on the table. My glass will be in its place when you stand."
"Why don't I just scream police?" Margot asked, though she was careful to ask it with a smile.
"You wouldn't live to scream it twice. By tomorrow, 3 doctors will have certified you had a heart attack."
They reached the table.
"Philip would never buy that. Your friend is drugged already. It's up to you to save him."
They did know we were coming, Margot thought. That sequined clutch was under her arm. She let it slip to the floor, set down her glass, and stooped to retrieve the bag. When she stood, there was a single glass on the mirror top, looking exactly like the one she'd placed there.
"How do you know isn't still yours?" she asked herself. "How do you know every glass in this place isn't drugged?"
The Countess said, "Now drink. They must think you took the drug, or they'll administer it more directly." "Right," Margot said with decision. She picked up the glass. "Confusion to our enemies." She drank the champagne down without a breath. The Countess opened her mouth to speak again, and then abruptly closed it, just as her husband had done earlier. Margot felt the hairs on the back of her neck rise.
"Miss Banning was a good girl, was she?"
Count Volganzi breathed in her ear. Margot dropped her glass, which was, accidentally, the perfect touch.
"Very good, I see," Volganzi said. "We must get her to the elevator. If you would take her left arm, my dear, while I take the light."
Margot walked between them, uncertain as how to act drugged. For a panicky second, she felt a sensation that she thought was a real drug taking effect. Then she realized it was the champagne she'd gulped down going to her head. Their goal appeared to be a little door with a diamond-shaped window. As she watched, a waiting footman, the man who delivered their Mickey Finns, opened the door, revealing an elevator car. The Countess squeezed her hand.
"Relax, my dear," she said in a flat voice. "Remember that it's always darkest before the dawn."
Then she hurried off. Volganzi operated the elevator himself, taking Margot up a single floor, then stepped out into a quiet hallway, and there was Philip St. Pierre, stumbling with bent knees between 2 burly men. Following his lead, Margot sagged against Volganzi's arm. She and the Count trailed the 2 into a paneled library. Above its cold fireplace was a portrait, lit like an icon, of Volganzi in full Nazi uniform. At the sight of it, Margot stumbled. The Count gripped her arm more tightly.
almost home, Miss Banning." The two men placed St-Pierre in a wooden chair in the center of the room while Voganzi led Margot to a leather settee.
"I don't think we need to keep you up," he said as he seated her.
Margot allowed her head to loll against the settee's tufted back. From beneath half-closed lids, he watched the Count approach St-Pierre.
"You, on the other hand, I wish to speak with."
He slapped the radio detective across the face.
"How were you able to trace that bail money to my wife? And what did you expect to accomplish here today? Did you come to protect our Russian friends or to snoop about? Answer me!"
St-Pierre raised his head.
"Who won the chucker?" he mumbled.
Voganzi slapped him again.
"Fool, do you think I meant to hurt the Russians? I merely wanted information. They told me they were planning to buy Curtiss P-40s. P-40s! That plane was obsolete before this war even started. Let the Russians spend every penny they have on our P-40s. They have my blessings."
"You do not. You have interfered with too many of our operations and given us far too much unwanted publicity. Even worse, you came too close to me. If I had allowed you to continue sooner or later, you would have realized it was I, the Balkan playboy, and not my wife, who was helping to find German operations in this country. So when I heard from above that you were coming here today, I was delighted." Margot held her breath. If St-Pierre was also faking, if he'd somehow anticipated and avoided the drugged champagne, this would be the moment when he would finesse the name of Volganzi's informant from the talkative Count. Instead, St-Pierre's head dropped until his chin was against his chest. He slipped from the chair and onto the tile floor.
"Leave him," Volganzi ordered his men. "They are both safe for an hour at least. We will talk again after this reception. Lock them in."
Margot didn't stir until she heard the room's deadbolt shoot home. Then she got up silently and went to examine the door. There were no latches or buttons for the lock on the inside. "Who had a study you locked from the outside like a bank vault?" The answer, Margot decided, was the Nazi graduation picture over the mantel. It wasn't something you'd want a visitor to happen upon, or a neighbor to see. She glanced about and confirmed that the room had no windows. Nor was there a phone on its massive desk. "Keep pitching," Margot, she told herself. What the room did have were books, bookcases after bookcase of them. They were separated by large wooden panels decorated with Egyptian symbols in faded paint and gilt. The fetish of the mansion's original builder, Margot thought, Vera Volganzi's grandfather. She sat on the floor beside St-Pierre and cradled his head in her lap. Volganzi's rough questioning had ruffled the detective's sleek hair, which now stood up like the crest of an angry bird. Margot smoothed it, thinking of their other close calls. They'd all ended when St-Pierre had pulled some surprise or the vital bit of information from his sleeve. She'd resented those surprises and withheld clues in the past, but she desperately wanted one now. Suddenly angry, she yanked on his ear for getting them into this mess. The spy smasher never even moaned. Margot knew that she would have to pull the latest surprise from her own cap sleeve. She was convinced that Vera had been about to tell her how to escape when the Count had snuck up behind them. That meant that a way out must exist. If only the Countess had said something meaningful when they'd parted instead of intoning a pep talk cliché, "Darkest before the dawn"? When Margot had that thought, she happened to be looking at the wall panel to the right of the fireplace. Its Egyptian decoration was a stylized hawk's head on which was balanced a gold disc. Having once attended a guided tour of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Margot knew the image to be Ra, the sun god. "Came the dawn," she said aloud.
Returning St. Pierre's head to the cold floor, she got to her feet. She crossed to the panel and checked it for hinges and a knob. Cleverly disguised, there were none. She tried to slide the panel. It wouldn't budge. In desperation, she reached up and pressed the golden disc with both hands. It yielded like a giant gilded button, and when the panel disappeared behind the nearest bookcase. Oh, thank you, sister. She found herself on the edge of a small landing. It was squeezed between the study and the exterior of the mansion, or so Margot judged from the rough finish of the stone block that made up the outer wall. To her right, a narrow staircase descended into darkness. She tried to rouse St. Pierre again, failed, and then began to drag him across the gleaming tile floor. It was hard work. She'd always thought of the detective as thin, and more than that, as somehow insubstantial, like a character from a particularly frothy book or movie. But as dead weight, Margot had to admit the sleuth got the job done. She dragged him as far as the little landing and then stopped to rest. Deciding to scout the dark staircase before risking both their necks on it, she descended a dozen steps and discovered a second landing blocked by a bolted door. Just as she reached for the bolt, someone on the door's far side knocked gently. The sound was so faint that Margot didn't actually jump, but she was shaken into giving the conventional response. "Who is it?" "Miss Banning." "Cliff Cleary?" Margot slid back the bolt and opened the door, barely giving herself time to wonder if she was only exchanging her cell for a dungeon in which Cleary himself was a prisoner. But the light of the match Cleary was holding aloft, she saw that he was free and alone. "How did you..." she began. Wait, tell me later." She guided Cleary up to where St. Pierre lay. She said, "I can take his legs, but..." By then, Cleary was lifting the detective onto one broad shoulder. "I'd better lead the way," he said. Beyond the lower landing was a second staircase, identical in length to the first. It ended in near total darkness. "Be careful where you step," Cleary told her. "There's a body down here." "Of course there is," Margot thought. She heard Cleary feel along the exterior wall and then open a door that wasn't opened very often, to judge by the sound its hinges made. Daylight flooded in, revealing a prone form in footman's livery.
I believe we've met," Margot said.
They emerged onto Fifth Avenue, only a few steps from the Packard Super 8. Margot and Cleary had St. Pierre loaded in the back seat before the men guarding the mansion's front door had time to do more than gape. "We want the full gangbusters treatment," Margot said when they were moving. "Head for the nearest police station." From there, she would call Peter Mitchell, St. Pierre's tame FBI agent, and maybe the National Guard. Margot had seated herself on the front seat beside Cleary, the better to question him. "Tell me how you found us," she ordered.
I didn't, Cleary said. "I was waiting by the car, keeping an eye on the mausoleum, when that side door opened. Some butler guy waved to me. I thought it might be a message from the boss, so I started over. Next thing I knew, he just folded up, and behind him, with a hunk of pipe in her hand, was a woman. She pointed to the staircase and then took off."
"What did she look like?" Cleary blushed again.
"Joan Bennett strikes again," Margot whispered. "God save her."
An hour and a half passed before Margot found herself back on Fifth Avenue in the now cool shadow of Volganzi's Palazzo. The police had declined her invitation to conduct an immediate raid, using the excuse of a warrant. Gangbuster it was not, Margot had decided ruefully. It hadn't helped that. In the earliest stage of his recovery, Philip St. Pierre had acted like a drunk from a musical comedy, reporting a stolen polo pony to every policeman he saw. The related appearance of Peter Mitchell with his G-men had produced solid results, but by then it had been too late.
When they'd arrived in the mansion, complete with warrant, they'd found only a squad of cleaning people setting the stone reception room back in order. No Soviet delegates, no guests, no Volganzis. The mansion's majordomo, a heel clicker named Gunther, adventured the opinion that his employers might have driven to their Connecticut estate, although he'd also recalled talk of Mexico. A search of the secret staircase had revealed no unconscious footman, and there had been no photograph of the Count in Nazi regalia over the fireplace in the Egyptian study. In its place had hung a portrait of a young Winston Churchill, dressed for polo, which Mitchell had pronounced a darn arrogant touch. St. Pierre had taken no part in the search. He now stood next to Margot on the Fifth Avenue sidewalk, looking like a stranger without his Homburg and cane. He was much more sober than he'd been at the police station, as sober, in fact, as Margot had ever seen him, and as uncomfortable, she decided, as he'd been on the June evening when he'd first invited her to dinner. "Hungover?" she asked. "Somewhat." The spy smasher reached up to smooth his blonde hair, which didn't need smoothing. As though trying to remember something, he repeated the gesture and then lightly touched his swollen right ear. Margot grew uncomfortable herself. I want to apologize, St. Pierre said, for putting you in such danger. Even his voice had changed, Margot thought. He usually sounded as though he was addressing a microphone, in the studio or out. Only last month, she reminded him, we were dodging machine gun bullets on the high seas. That was different. I'd anticipated danger and prepared for it. Today, I just blundered in. I know you think I always do, but today it was true. Our run of good luck made me cocksure. God knows where we'd be right now if it hadn't been for you. If it hadn't been for Vera Volganzi, Margot admitted. Philip, they didn't just hope we'd blundered in. They knew we were coming. Someone warned them. The Count let that slip when he was trying to question you. Did he? Margot saw a spark of interest in his tired eyes. To fan it, she added, I hope the Countess is okay. So do I. If her motive for saving us was pure, she could be an important ally. That was more in character. Her relief made Margot smile. Just an ally? She asked. Not a rumba partner? St. Pierre was smiling too, though wryly. We'll see. In the meantime, let's step inside. I seem to recall checking a hat and a stick. All right, I've switched over to a different issue of the Alfred Hitchcock magazine. Janice Law is the author, and the story is called Up and Gone. Grant unlocked the back door and stuck his head in the kitchen. Evelyn? No answer. She should have been back for hours since the psychiatrist office she managed closed early on Fridays. But a glance at the coat hooks showed her green topcoat was missing. Offer a late lunch with friends? That was something she'd been doing lately, although she complained high and low when he ate alone at the club. Evelyn had become a lady who lunched, Grant thought, and yet he sensed that something was wrong, or, and here he suppressed a nervous giggle, perhaps something was right, very right. He hung up his hat and coat, threw his car keys onto the counter, and walked briskly through the house, dining room, living room, tiny powder room downstairs, three bedrooms and bath above. He hesitated at the door of their bedroom, uncertain of what he felt and even more uncertain of what he hoped to find.
Evelyn?
No answer. Grant crossed the room to their shared closet, lots of shirts and blouses, but fewer than usual. He was sure there were fewer than usual. And her overnight bag, a round fake snakeskin number with a combination lock, was nowhere in sight. Grant poked amid shoes and purses to make sure before checking her underwear drawer. Not empty, but not overstuffed either. Evelyn was gone, and Grant felt his heart lift. Well, momentarily, that is, for this pleasant thought, opening as it did the prospect of a wholly different life, it could not last. Evelyn would surely be back. She'd taken off from work, maybe literally taken flight, although that overnight bag suggested a swift return to the increasingly sour atmosphere of Shea Morton. Still, Grant was not one to reject opportunity. He threw himself down on the bed with his shoes on, loosened his tie, and thought that he could at least construct a pleasant weekend for himself, starting with dinner out, since Evelyn hadn't left even a goodbye note, never mind a casserole. Would she have put something in writing, saying perhaps, "This isn't working out, I'm gone for good," or "You'll be happier without me, I'm not coming back," or nicer, though unlikely, "It was good for a while, don't blame yourself," and signed, "Love, Evelyn." That would have been ideal, even if I'm leaving you, bum, would have been a pleasant finality. Evelyn's style was different. As usual, she'd created uncertainty and aggravation when she could have made life easy and pleasant. Grant allowed himself a few moments of irritation, then swapped his office clothes for the bright sport coat Evelyn criticized as loud, and set off for the Oakwood, the neighborhood bar and grill, where he intended to flirt with Allie, the prettiest of the bartenders, and have a steak dinner. If anyone asked, "And where's Evelyn?" he intended to say, "Oh, she's up and gone," and make them laugh. That's exactly what he did. Allie was sympathetic, although Grant was not foolish enough to hope for more. Mildly flirtatious with her older customers, quick with a retort with the younger guys, she was a complete pro who never took home work with her. Still, he couldn't help thinking that someone along Allie's lines would suit him much better than querulous Evelyn. Conflict was the breath of life for his wife, and she rarely found a complaint she couldn't nurture. Grant spent the weekend pretending that she was gone for good. He stayed out late and fueled up for golf the next morning with a high-caloric breakfast at the coffee shop. After lunch at the club, he played tennis, followed by a few too many drinks in the members' lounge. When Evelyn's usual doubles partners interrupted his pleasant program to ask why his missus wasn't on the court, Grant said, "She's up and gone, Patty," and left me desolate, which everyone in the house treated as a huge joke. Come Monday morning, and still no sign of Evelyn, Grant considered that reaction. Most likely, they thought that she'd been in a snit and had dispatched him to find his own meals. That was certainly like Evelyn, who leaned to scenes and tantrums, though she had now been gone more than 48 hours without a word. Grant thought that if her friends weren't worried, maybe he didn't have to take her absence seriously either. He reminded himself of that Tuesday evening when he again found the house empty and a raft of messages on the answer machine. Dr. Molinar's office sounded quite frantic, and so did someone from the annual heart drive and someone else from the Fresh Air Fund. Grant sniffed at both. In his mind, Evelyn was much lacking in the heart department and was not much on fresh air either. Although he decided to ignore the worthy causes, he called back after Dr. Molinar's hours and lied that Evelyn had come down with a flu of some sort. Her GP thought it might take a few days to get over the highly contagious strain. Grant was pleased with himself at that touch. Doctor's offices are nervous about anything contagious. Would he tell Evelyn about her illness when she came back, or let her get caught out in a lie? Either was a possible excuse for Evelyn's temporary disappearance, a sick mother or father, a cousin's wedding, a sibling who needed some sorting out, a lover. Knowing their family situation, Grant decided a lover would be the most likely possibility, seen perhaps at those supposedly girls' lunches in town. Who could the unlucky man be? Everyone they knew at the club had been present and accounted for over the weekend. Ditto the crowd at the Oakwood. What about a patient at Dr. Molinar's? Well, maybe a plausible psychopath who had charmed her over insurance cards and drug refills. There was certainly cinematic precedent. He remembered his namesake romancing his way out of a booby hatch via Ingrid Bergman. But that was romantic fiction. Evelyn was probably too hard-headed or too self-centered to fall for a literal lady killer. Just the same, Grant thought it wise to empty their joint account and cancel their credit cards. He had a few minutes of anxiety when he pulled up their figures, but there were no suspicious withdrawals, not even quick cash out of the ATM or new charges on their cards. He was relieved, and yet it gave him such a strange feeling that he did what he had promised himself he would do. He tried Evelyn's cell phone. It gave a little half ring and went to voicemail, where a helpful android informed him that Evelyn Morton's mailbox was full. That full mailbox was doubtless why he began to get a stream of calls, including one from Patty of the tennis group, who demanded to know if he had informed the police. Grant finessed that with a spiel about Evelyn needing space, about his respecting her privacy, and a lot of other trendy phrases that for the moment seemed to pacify her doubles partner. For the moment only, he realized, Patty was a bulldog on the court and active with some women lawyers group. Then there was Kathy, part of the supposed lunch gang, so maybe it was real after all. A group of gossiping, complaining sisters, and Grant spoke vaguely about Evelyn's need for psychic space and intimated that he expected her back by the weekend. From then on, the house phone and Grant's cell rang with maniacal persistence. He stopped picking up, and he felt so fussed that he trashed the pink towels and flowered sheets Evelyn favored and deposited the remainder of her clothes and shoes in a big receptacle that promised to save the planet. The loss would serve her right, he thought, for Grant still expected her return. It was too much to expect Evelyn, a diva of the first water, to disappear quietly. What he didn't expect was that some friendly busybody would call the police and file a missing persons report. His vague notions about psychic space and Evelyn's privacy didn't cut any ice with the local constabulary, nor with the local weekly newspaper either. Grant, who had adjusted to a comparatively tranquil existence post-Evelyn, now found himself shunned at the club, denounced on the net, and questioned by local detectives. To be fair, he realized that he hadn't done himself any good with his precipitous house cleaning and some indiscreet dinners with a secretary who worked in a nearby realtor's office. His cleaner not only quit, but spoke to the papers and probably to the police, too, for they arrived early one morning with a search warrant. When their examination of closets and chests and dressers and desks turned up nothing, they returned with a bobcat to excavate the backyard landscaping, and two stocky guys went into the basement and started digging up the dirt floor crawl space. None of these developments was good, and given that his insurance company believed their agents must represent the highest ethical standard, Grant could foresee that he would very soon lose his job. It was at this moment, when he was suspect numero uno and anticipating a pink slip daily, that he returned from work to find the back door unlocked, and the whole house reverberating with the classic rock Evelyn favored. There was a pot of coffee on the stove, and the washer was running full tilt. She was home. Grant stood in the kitchen with his ears ringing and wondered whether he felt more relief or anger. It was a moment or two before he called Evelyn and went to the foot of the stairs. She appeared from the bedroom, no worse, it seemed, for her adventure, but no better either. She was furious about her missing clothes and new sheets and towels and a dozen other subtle decor changes, and she really got revved up on his heartlessness. He had left her stranded by canceling their credit cards and emptying their accounts. He hadn't searched for her. He hadn't even reported her missing. When Grant interrupted to suggest she should call Dr. Molinar's office, Evelyn threw up her hands. She was done with them and quite a few other things, too. But though she'd had insights and growth, two of her favorite words, and although she understood her life a whole lot better and her goals were clear in mind, to Grant's disappointment, she apparently was not through with him. He had rather hoped for talk of a divorce, an amicable separation, or news of some ardent and besotted lover. No such luck. At the realization that his life was about to return to storms and turmoil, Grant felt an anger as an incandescent fluid, an actual physical thing screaming to be released, and their marriage might have ended right there in the front hallway if he had not remembered there were upsides to Evelyn's return. It would be both pleasant and useful to be vindicated, and once again, and ever after, he hoped, presumed innocent. Although he never neglected an opportunity, Grant was capable of waiting for the right moment to seize one. That was where Evelyn underestimated him. With her return, the country club set was chagrined and a bit ashamed. Grant was magnanimous in public, if privately dismissing them as weasels. The Oakwood crowd greeted him cheerfully, pretending that they never had any doubts. The police naturally were too important and cynical for apologies, but the town did send a landscaper over to repair the bobcat damage, and Grant upgraded for several really nice shrubs at town expense. Best of all, although his boss said nothing, the atmosphere in the office lifted. And soon, Grant's only real complaint was the end of his convivial dinners with the realtor's nice secretary. Even the local paper, which had outdone itself in covering the mystery, made a modest attempt at putting a small notice of Evelyn's safe return on page 3. With that, the bases were covered, and to all intents and purposes, Grant was cleared of the monstrous suspicion that turned out to be totally unfounded. He could honestly say that he was thankful that he had not succumbed to his terrible anger on the night of Evelyn's return. Respectability and likability are no mean things, and Grant intended to preserve them. At the same time, life with Evelyn was intolerable, a constant turmoil made worse by the fact that she had decided to start a management consulting business. Now she was home all the time, except when she needed a day. And where she went, and what she did then, Grant never discovered. But when she took an unannounced overnight, cruelly raising his hopes, he assessed the possibilities and made up his mind. He was an upstanding citizen whose wife periodically flew the coop without warning or explanation. He would be slow indeed if he couldn't make something out of that situation, and one fall night, he acted. That Saturday, he arrived at the club looking serious, He played a round of golf with his usual partners, but he didn't have much to say and had a few more drinks than usual before lunch. When Patty swept in, rackets in hand, and called, "Where's Evelyn?" Grant managed a genuinely sad look.
"Well, I'm afraid she's gone," he said. "The police are putting out a silver alert. She's been taking off now and again, but never for more than an overnight."
"You're kidding."
He shook his head.
"Eh, no joke."
The crowd in the lounge were sympathetic, for Grant looked like a man who'd had a shock and was taking his wife's disappearance seriously. The feelings around town that he'd been badly misjudged and that, whatever the state of their marriage, this time Evelyn was very much in the wrong. Grant, always so patient and jolly, was now seen as admirably forbearing. Given everything he'd been through, he felt that assessment was only fair, and he worked hard to justify the town's new opinion. For, honestly, his friend's suspicious imaginations and the aggressive local police had enabled everything. Everything, that is, except the deep anger in his soul that swung the cast-iron pan against Evelyn's head. He would never forget the sound of iron on bone or her ghastly cry. But everything else had been prepared and laid out for him. He doubted that he would have managed the compacted floor of the crawl space, certainly not to the proper depth. If the police had not only broken up the soil, but indicated a solution. And, as the husband in a testy marriage, he would have been under immediate suspicion without his friends and neighbors' guilty awareness of their previous rush to judgment. But, although Grant had seemingly been inoculated against guilt by that ruinous dose of suspicion, he occasionally wondered how long his innocence might last. He realized that he could become a suspect at any time, a thought that made his present life provisional. Even more distressing was the realization that even innocence could turn sinister. For, resist as he might, Grant occasionally found himself tempted to rely on his immunity and eliminate some new source of irritation or opposition. That would never do, and yet the thought would never leave him. On the fatal night, he had released a dark force that lingered as a reckless impulse to disaster. Perhaps we become what we imagine, Grant thought. Evelyn imagined escape and found an open exit door. He imagined her gone and became a killer. On some days, he feared one result was as permanent as the other. Well, wonderful listeners, thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler here asking you to tune in again next time, would you please? Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.